Hello and welcome to another episode of the Richards Report. I'm Ted Richards. This week I have a special guest. In fact, a special international guest. He's over in Michigan in the US, and I'm a big fan of his writing and his podcast, so a bit of a fan moment for me. I'm speaking with Ben Carlson, a director of institutional asset management at Ritholtz Wealth Management, and the person behind the fantastic blog, A Wealth of Common Sense. Ben has recently released a book called Don't Fall For It. The cover of the book describes it as a short history of financial scams. But it's really much more than that. The book is more than just anecdotes of scams over the years. It also includes the psychology behind the scammer's strategy and why it was successful on their targets. It makes you check yourself and your own decision making. A lot of it comes back to behavioral economics, a topic I've spoken about in previous episodes, and how scammers tap into the irrational ways we usually come to a decision, which isn't as rational as you probably assume it is. Check out my previous episodes with lecturers from Harvard Business School if you'd like to learn more about the biases and heuristics we use when making decisions. Before we jump straight into the discussion, I just want to reflect on why I think it's worth discussing this topic. As I'm well aware, you may be thinking, don't worry about me, I can spot a scam a mile away. Well, there's three reasons why I want to have this chat. The first reason is that when I refer to scams, I'm using the term quite broadly. Don't get too anchored and bogged down as to what you think a typical scam looks like. I'm not just referring to some obvious pyramid scheme. Scams can take on all sorts of different looks, such as from the infamous Fire Festival, which you might have seen in a recent documentary on Netflix, to the failed WeWork IPO, which was also a scam in that it was the largest wipeout of shareholder value since Enron. The second reason I want to talk about this has to do with one of my heroes, and that's Howard Marks and his fund Oak Tree Capital. Well, their motto is, avoid the losers and let the winners take care of themselves. The first part of their motto is all about avoiding the losers, which we're speaking about today. The third and final reason why I want to speak about this topic is because investing is not just the study of finance. It's more about the study of how people behave with their money. It doesn't matter how smart you are, we can all be susceptible to irrational decision making. I put this podcast together every month to try and provide insight for listeners about investing, and I believe we shouldn't just ignore the horrific investments people have made in the past as they thought at the time they were making a good investment. And there's lessons we can learn from these mistakes too. History shows us that they were often made by very smart people too, that up to that point had a track record of good decision making. So it's not always easy targets you may assume the victims all are. On this podcast, we chat about the success stories a lot and the investments people have made. But the problem with only studying successes is they're often overflowing with something called survivorship bias. So for this episode, let's look at the other side of the equation. Before I get into it, the usual disclosures. This podcast is just for educational purposes only and does not qualify as financial advice. And people may hold positions in companies discussed. And as always, show notes for this episode will be available on the Six Park website, sixpark.com.au, S-I-X-P-A-R-K. With no further ado, my name is Ted Richards. You're listening to The Richards Report. And here is my chat with Ben Carlson.
You're listening to The Richards Report, where we will speak with investment experts from around the country. We will cut through the jargon to allow you to make more insightful investment decisions for your future. This is The Richards Report.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for joining me for the chat today. Let's have a chat about your fantastic new book, Don't Fall For It. Before we speak about it, I saw on social media that friend of the show, Matt Williams from Airlie Funds Management in Australia, has also recently purchased your book. Ben, you're probably not aware, but Matt is a fund manager managing billions of dollars at Airlie and previously headed up Perpetual. So for listeners, it gives a bit of an idea as to how respected Ben's writing is. So Ben, let's get back to the book. I like your book for a few reasons, and one of which is the length. And what I mean here is that there must have been a temptation to write a longer book for the sake of it, because apparently people are more attracted to thicker books when they're shopping. I assume this was intentional. What was your thinking here in writing a shorter book than, say, the average?
Well, thanks for having me, and thanks for the heads up on the fund managers in Australia buying the book. I appreciate that. I fought my publishers on this pretty hard. The way that it typically works is they give you a certain amount, a number of words that they would like you to hit. And I think I've even heard that one of the reasons for that is because they want a minimum of like 240 words, because in the past, that was what you could read on the spine of a book. So if you were at the library or a bookstore and you were walking by, it had to be a certain amount of thickness for you to notice that book. And of course, today when many people buy books on Amazon or read digitally or read in a number of different forms, that really shouldn't matter anymore. So a lot of it is just things that people have always done. So I pushed back and I wanted to keep it short. And I said I wanted it to be, you know, 170 to 180 pages, because I wanted it to be a book that a lot of people could read. And I think a lot of people's eyes kind of glaze over when they see a 300 or 400 page book. And there's nothing wrong with reading a good book if it's worth it. But a lot of books are just a lot of filler. And again, I just wanted to make it more accessible to more people, because I know for some people it can be hard to make it through any book. So I wanted to just make it easier for people and really focus on only the best stories and details and data and information and cut everything else out.
Well, you're exactly right. I read it on my Kindle. It was something that I thought of, that there was no real unnecessary filler. I like your strategy, and I hope other authors use that. All right, let's discuss one of the topics, and that's about technology, in particular new technology and the internet. You'd think the internet provides us with incredible ways to filter and research when we think we might be scammed, but the scammers still get away with it, and I'm speaking quite broadly here. Does new technology usually help us or create new opportunities for us to be scammed?
Unfortunately, it can make it harder. I was just having an argument this weekend with some friends about, I don't know what people did in the past when they had these minor arguments about some minutia, an old movie or something that was unanswered, without using Google, because in the past it was harder to access information. And now we have, you know, as much information as we could ever want in a lifetime at our fingertips. But if you don't have a good filter in place, then it's really difficult to understand what to trust, because there's just so much of, there's this fire hose coming at you every day of information, whether it's news or social media or alerts or just things that are going on in people's lives. So if you don't have a good filter in place, it's hard to know what to trust. So there was a story in the book about a woman who was Facebook messaged by Jason Statham, who is a big action movie star.
I love that one.
And this woman thought she was befriending this huge Hollywood A-list star and got to know him. And he said, "Hey, I'm in between movies making Fast and the Furious. I'm just a little short on cash. Could you send me six figures?" And this woman handed over six figures to what she thought was an A-list Hollywood celebrity, who of course turned out to be a fake that was making it up and took off with all of her money. And so, yes, it should be easier for people to look stuff up, but I think there's also more avenues where people can be taken advantage of.
I feel like throughout your book, there's many similarities with new technology, which the internet is, and the railroad boom, which was a graveyard for hundreds of failed investments. You speak about that quite a lot throughout the book too.
It is kind of wild that railway bubble of the 1800s was one that I was honestly not too familiar with before doing some research for the book. And it's pretty mind-boggling when you think about the fact that the public in Great Britain actually were the ones who funded the majority of the railway build out there when trains really took off. And they were building these almost private equity-like strategies where the public, and a lot of times it was middle-class people, would fund these huge railway projects, and they were promised these massive yields on them. And people got taken for everything they were worth in a lot of cases, where people went broke and these shares of these railroad companies went bust. A lot of it was due to the fact that it was almost like a pump and dump scheme. But I can't imagine that today, where the public would literally fund a huge infrastructure project, whether it was the rebuild of a highway or a massive bullet train system or something like that. And that's kind of what happened back then. And the one corollary was the internet of the 1990s. We had this big dot-com bubble, and we had this huge overfunding of fiber optic cables that really wasn't necessary at the time, but that really built the infrastructure for the internet. And although a lot of those companies and investments failed, that build out remained, and it was one of the positives of the bubble, even on the other side.
Ben, you've already touched on quite a few of the stories and anecdotes throughout the book, and I'm not going to cover every topic in the book, because I think listeners really need to buy the book and read it for themselves. But there's two areas that you cover that I want to kind of dig into a bit and chat with you about in this podcast episode, and they are the opportunities that present themselves to scam people in good economic times. And the other topic that I want to speak to you about that you talk about is professional athletes. So let's talk about good economic times first, as even the most pessimistic of people have got to acknowledge that from a stock market perspective, we've had a great last decade. In the US, I believe it's been around 9 or 10 years since your last recession. In Australia, we're coming up for 28, 29 years. No country has gone as long as Australia has without a recession. So do you think here in Australia we could be more susceptible right now than other parts of the world to scamming?
It was one of the more interesting aspects of the book I found. The more I researched, I was just interested in the people who were being these con artists and scam artists and hucksters and taking advantage, and what their motives were and what some of the incentives were. And the more stories I read, the more I realized that there was really this thread running through a lot of these financial frauds. And one of them was just anytime the markets really took off and we had this massive bull market. And a lot of times it was even entering bubble territory where it happened. And I think it just makes it harder to look at something critically when things are happening in a good way and people are optimistic and you see other people making money, and you get this fear of missing out, and you see your friends, your neighbors, your coworkers, your peers getting rich. It just becomes a little harder to think about things like risk management and thinking through some things and taking your time, and people just want to go, go, go. So anytime there's just been this period of things going well and people are very optimistic about the future, it can be much harder to look at these things through a critical lens.
Yep, never underestimate the power of FOMO and how it influences all sorts of decisions, from how people can be influenced by looking at other people's holidays through social media to kind of what we're seeing right now with the property market and a bit of FOMO returning there. Okay, that's the first topic that I wanted to discuss with you. The other is professional athletes and the psychology behind why their financial situation can often spiral out of control. Can you tell us a little about that?
One of the hard parts about coming into a big pile of money, especially when you're young and often inexperienced in dealing with financial matters, is it can just be hard to get used to because you don't have that transition phase where you're slowly building up either your income or your savings and your portfolio over time. And so coming into this big pile of money, and that could be for anyone, whether it's an inheritance or winning the lottery or anything like that, it's hard to wrap your head around that though that money won't last forever. And going from this change in lifestyle where your lifestyle can oftentimes grow exponentially higher than your income or the money that you have saved. And so I think it's really hard for people to wrap their heads around the fact that this won't last forever and we do have to plan for the future and not just the next couple of years, because that high income doesn't always last forever.
Ben, I totally agree. I've seen firsthand exactly what you mentioned then. I think something that is often overlooked is the influence that other people and players in the locker room can have on the spending patterns of the players. Young players want to fit in and have the status, and I think that can affect their behavior with money too. There's emotions like jealousy, which probably plays a role too. And as you mentioned, the dangers of lifestyle creep, where your lifestyle increases in proportion with your salary. So at the end of the day, you're not actually saving anything, which you touched on too.
Yeah, and there's a lot of ways, times we live our lives, especially financially, in a relative world. So we're comparing ourselves to our peers, and especially in that realm, you're watching what other people are doing and not necessarily what you should be doing.
And it doesn't discriminate. You might think this only happens with the athletes that are on the fringe, that aren't making as much as the superstars in the team and don't go on to have the incredible careers. It's not just these players that can have financial troubles. It's just as likely as the superstars on the megabucks that could have the troubles too.
No, and yeah, and some of the people I profiled in the book were all pros and Hall of Famers. And sometimes those people have an even bigger target on their back, because then they have friends and family and people coming out of the woodwork that are looking for a handout. And it's tough to say no when you have that much money. And it can be hard to figure out what is a good opportunity and what's not, and what's a good allocation of your time and energy and money. And so it's difficult. And again, this gets back to having a filter in place of knowing when to understand to say no to people. It's really hard, especially when you have a lot of money.
I like the line about one of the best ways to persuade someone to do something is to allow them to come to the conclusion themselves. And I really like this, even though that I haven't had much luck with my wife, but this is totally agree with the principle. The last question on the book that I'd like to ask you is, in your final chapter, you go through what to look out for in a scam, an action item for each one. I won't go through all six, but I will call out two, which I really liked because they're pretty consistent with Robert Cialdini's form of influence. That is, the scams are often, one, exclusive, and two, the scammers position themselves to have a higher level of expertise in that specific area. Ben, why does this exclusivity in a deal, what does it do to motivate people to act?
And this is especially true of those who have some level of success and maybe some level of wealth, is that they assume because they have more money that there should be this secret club or this holy grail which allows them these investment opportunities which other people shouldn't have access to. And so anytime you have this aura of exclusivity, it's almost like you're in on the secret, and you don't want to miss out because there's obviously other wealthy people that are open to these opportunities, and why would you pass on something like this? And I think there's also this idea that you should be able to understand these things because you have success in one realm of life, and you hope that it transfers into another, which is building your wealth and investing in the markets. And that success doesn't always translate as neatly as people would like to believe, because a lot of times when you have success in one arena in life, it just leads to overconfidence elsewhere.
I totally agree. One thing that I picked up on in football, and which Jim Collins also talks about in his books, is the dangers of hubris, which can creep in if you get overly confident about your own abilities in an area or in many areas. And it's important to stay humble, be it football, investing, or other pursuits. Okay, pivoting from your book to where you work right now, which is Ritholtz Wealth Management, I saw that you've partnered with Betterment, a robo-advisor in the US. Can you please tell us a bit about that partnership and how it works?
Sure. It's one of those things where a lot of people in the financial advisory industry, especially when these robo-advisors came to light a number of years ago, they really thought that it was going to be an us versus them mentality. And especially when it comes to technology, we think there's no reason to fight it. This stuff is going to happen one way or the other, another. So we think it's best to embrace it. And one of the reasons we partnered with them is because they have this really best in breed technology, we feel. And we thought, why not use what they do well and what we do well and use their portfolio management software and their tax loss harvesting and the ease of access with which to sign up for one of their accounts and their really slick and smooth technology, and then partner it with some sort of financial advice that we can give them with some of our advisors. And we have an advisor who is tasked with overseeing that. And a lot of the people who sign up for that, it's called Liftoff, is the name of our robo platform. They may have some financial advising questions, but maybe not as in depth as some of the other ones, as our clients who are a little further along their investment life cycle. So we think it's a great platform, especially for young people who are slowly building wealth over time. And any time you can make your life more efficient in terms of using technology, we think that's a great thing for both us running a business and for the clients who are using the interface to invest their money.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's not about technology versus human, but rather technology complementing what the humans can provide and working together.
And we think a lot of clients are going to be just asking for this stuff in the years ahead. They want to make their lives easier too. So we think, yeah, there's no reason to fight this wave that's coming. It's just an uphill battle if you're doing that.
As I said earlier, I'm a big fan of your podcast, Animal Spirits. For listeners unaware of this, make sure you check it out. You co-host it with Michael Batnick, and I'm so impressed at the quality that you can punch out every week. I struggle with the time it takes to put one episode out a month, let alone one a week. How have you found the process of putting a podcast together? And more importantly, how do you get them out weekly?
It's one of the favorite things that I get to do every week. And Michael and I, we live in different cities. I work remotely, so I'm in Michigan and Michael's in New York City. And So we are constantly talking because the two of us are, you know, both writing on our blogs, and we've both written some books, and we both are on the investment committee at our firm. And so we're constantly sharing ideas and things that we're reading and watching and thinking about. And I think we were on speakerphone for a while, and Josh Brown, who was one of the co-founders and our CEO of our firm, said one of the times, said, "Can you guys just stop having this conversation and tape it sometime, so I don't have to keep listening to it myself?" and we just kind of, yeah. And so we just kind of decided to take it to a podcast and see what would happen. And it took a while to get used to that medium. It was a different way of communicating, and it's not as easy as it sounds to just turn on the mic and go. So we had to make sure we kept it very loose and informal and conversational, while also having a little bit of structure behind it in terms of the topics and some of the things that we've thought through. So it's really fun, and we think it's a great way for us to really think through some of the stuff that we're really working on at the moment. And it's also been great in terms of the feedback we get from listeners, because they try to hold us accountable and they send us ideas and thoughts on some of the things we're talking about. And oftentimes we're working through an idea, and in the coming weeks we'll hear even more about that through research that people send us. So it's a great platform, I think, for people to have some give and take. And podcasting is definitely a medium in which people feel like they get to know you better and they get to understand your personality. And as long as that comes out in a good, authentic way, I think it's been really, really good for us.
This episode is brought to you by Six Park. Six Park is an Australian-based investment manager that sets up and manages your own globally diversified portfolio over Australian and international shares, bonds, property, infrastructure, and cash. All assets are held in your name, and the Six Park portfolio asset allocation is overseen by the Six Park Investment Committee. Returns for the calendar year of 2019 in the Six Park Growth Portfolio was 23.1%. As always, past performance is not an indication of future performance. To take the free online risk assessment, go to sixpark.com.au and click Try Six Park Now. Back to my discussion with Ben. Ben, on the topic of feedback, some might call it the constructive feedback we receive from time to time. Some might call it hate mail. How do you go in that area? Do you receive any form of feedback like this?
Yeah, occasionally we do get some. I mean, the podcast, and then we have a YouTube channel and Twitter and all these places. There's a lot of people who just are not shy about giving you feedback. And some of it is really easy to laugh off. Some of it kind of gets under your skin a little bit. I guess if you've been doing it for a while, it's easy to, you know, laugh it off. But there are times when you get constructive feedback and you realize, okay, that this is a different way of thinking about it or looking at it. Or if it gets into the personal realm, that's always never easy to hear. But it's something we deal with. And a lot of times Michael and I will share that stuff with each other and laugh it off and move on and not really worry about it too much. But it's certainly something that we deal with.
Yeah, coming from my previous career playing football, there was a lot of keyboard warriors that would provide me feedback, letting me know of what they thought of my ability to play the game. So I'm kind of used to it a bit, but it's funny, we put this out there, it takes time, you put effort into it, and we don't charge people for it, and there's still people that out there that...
Yeah, and it's certainly why, and I can get it, because the first time I started blogging, I guess it must have been 6 or 7 years ago at this point, it was pretty nerve-wracking just to put your thoughts out there in the world, because you never know. Sometimes it could just hit with a thud and you get zero feedback, and that means that, you know, no one's reading your stuff. But if you get a lot of feedback, you know, both positive and negative, that means you're at least making people think, I guess. But yeah, it's from, you do get some comments from the cheap seats that are not always very constructive, but that's kind of the way the internet works these days, I suppose.
Ben, onto your blog, I'm a huge fan of that too. I can't get over the amount of content that you can create, both with podcasting and on your blog, A Wealth of Common Sense, which it'll be in the show notes. Can you tell me about what you're writing and for listeners that have never read any of your work, what they might see?
The whole idea behind my blog when I initially started it, and it's something that I've tried to keep throughout my writing process, is just, I was trying to explain the complex topics in finance and the markets and investing in just a way that normal people could understand it, because those are the questions that I was getting from my family and friends and peers and in-laws and that all those people were constantly asking me these questions. And I wanted to think of a way to just tell them all at once and say, just go read this instead of asking me this same thing every month. And that was the idea behind it. It was this, I don't know if it's, if he actually said it or if it's a, just an internet myth, but there was a quote attributed to Einstein where he just said, if you can't explain it to a 6-year-old, you probably don't understand it yourself. And that was always the goal for me, just to understand and wade through all the fog and the noise and help people understand what's going on and put it into context. And even if I don't myself understand what's going on, just go through my thought process. And I've really found that the writing process, which is not something that I really did before on a regular basis, it really helps me to collect my thoughts as well and understand what it is that I'm thinking. Because if to go from your head to the keyboard or a piece of paper, it's a different process, and it makes you really challenge your own beliefs and really make sure that before you hit that publish button that you thought through all the different angles before you put it out there.
Ben, I agree. I do writing for the Six Park newsletter and for other websites too. I find it a great process to clarify my thinking. And in the financial world, so many people intentionally use jargon to make themselves sound smarter, when I think it's actually a better skill if you can make it simpler so people can understand what they're listening and reading. I'd like to wrap up our conversation with a quote from your book, which really underlines why I wanted to speak with you today. And the quote is, "Markets, economies, regulations, and technology are constantly changing and adapting, but human nature remains the one constant throughout history." Ben, thank you for chatting on the Richards Report.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Okay, that was my conversation with Ben Carlson. Show notes for the episode will be available on the Six Park website. Ben's book is called Don't Fall For It, full of some great stories, which I didn't get to throughout this episode, like the guy who sold the Eiffel Tower to someone not just once, but twice. Ben's blog is called A Wealth of Common Sense, which I mentioned, and his podcast is called Animal Spirits. He's also very active on Twitter, so check him out in all those different forms of media too. Thanks for listening, and thanks to those who have given me a rating or shared the podcast with a friend. I really appreciate it. You can catch me on Twitter at TedRichards25, and I'm also on Instagram too. The Instagram activity is mostly putting up pictures of my beehive, which I'm proud to say is finally producing some honey, but probably best a topic of conversation for another time. Okay, that's it from me. See you next time on The Richards Report.